Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to Cinematic Universe, a podcast that's all about comic book movies, brought to you by FilmDivider.com. I'm Joe Cunningham, and joining me to help make sense of the comics behind the movies are
James Hunt
and Ian Grundy.
So, Seb is not joining us this week. He has a very busy schedule. And also knows probably even less than me about manga and anime and Ghost in the Shell. But we are joined by Ian this week. Ian, do you want to let the listeners know a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, I'm an anime expert, a very hotly in demand sort of expert. well, to be honest, I watched anime a lot a few years ago, but haven't watched a whole lot lately. So a lot of my knowledge might be a bit out of date. But I do know about Ghost in the Shell, fortunately. I know too much about Ghost in the Shell, maybe.
Ian's like my anime guru. Like he took me from watching Ghost in the Shell to watching sort of more anime generally.
Okay, we'll be discussing the latest comic book movie and TV news this week before launching into our spoiler-filled discussion of Mamoru Oshii's 1995 film Ghost in the Shell. But before any of that, before any of that, I'm going to ask James and Ian to explain a comic book or maybe anime/manga concept that, as a movie fan, I just don't understand. I'm going to keep it fairly broad this week, guys. Can you explain manga to me? Like, what defines manga? What makes it different? Is it just Japanese comic books, or is there any like defining characteristics that define manga?
Manga is literally Japanese for comics. So in the same way, what we call comics, the French would call bande dessinée. We call Japanese people call comics manga. It doesn't help that there is an anime company called Manga. That confused me, teenage me, for a long time.
It confused everyone. Like,
yeah.
You'd often say, "Hey, did you watch the latest manga?" And you'd be like, "What are you talking about?"
But yeah, like the only characteristic of manga that distinguishes it from comics is that because it's Japanese, you read it right to left.
Okay, and so in terms of the animation style, is it just that manga tends to have the Eastern animation style rather than a Western one? Is that why? I mean, would it be fair to say if I was looking at a page and there weren't any letters on it to give it away, I'd probably know what was an American comic and what was a Japanese one?
Yeah, I mean, probably.
I think another big difference is that it's often not coloured in manga. It's right. Just black and white and, you know, shading and such. So
yeah, I mean, the tradition of manga is quite different to the tradition of comics in that manga is kind of presented in sort of giant disposable phone books, basically, and read in weekly chapters of about 12 pages, maybe. Whereas with Western comics, you get sort of 20 pages, full colour, little pamphlet every month.
And so when it comes to the movie adaptations, like, so Ghost in the Shell is an anime adaptation. And again, so like anime, I think, probably has a distinctive style. The Japanese animation, you can usually spot pretty distinctively from Western animation. Do mangas tend to be directly adapted into anime, or is there a tradition of live action adaptations as well?
I'd say there's both.
Like animation, manga get adapted all over the place. Like you're literally there are TV shows, there are live action movies, animated movies. There are these things called light novels, which are like sort of short fiction prose that spin out like
young adult.
Well, yeah, quite. If people want to license their manga, there is no shortage of outlets for ways to translate it into other mediums.
The other thing to remember is manga is vastly, vastly more popular in Japan than anime. Manga, if you go on your average Japanese train or something, or bus, half the people there will be reading some sort of manga, like either from the phone book size things that are being James is describing, or just the little books. But yeah, everyone really reads manga. And the reason why that is at least this is how I understand it, is that reading proper books in Japan is way more difficult than it is for Western, with our nice 26 character alphabet. So the more looking at pictures of scenes and stuff they can do, the better.
Right.
And they don't have to know 8,000 extra symbols for, like, the old novels and stuff like
that.
So.
I'd never actually thought of it that way, but that's interesting, yeah.
And so in regards to Ghost in the Shell specifically, would you probably find that, you know, in Japan, as many, if not more, people would know the source material as they would the film? Or has the film transcended in the same way it has over here?
It's hard to say, because the film was a huge hit. So I imagine most people would have come in through the film.
Yeah, I'd say that as well.
Yeah, because the manga, we'll get to talking about it properly later, but I think the manga was quite a niche piece of science fiction. Like, the thing to remember is that sort of popular manga tends to be, it's like things like sporting manga.
Prince of Tennis,
yeah. Like, that's the kind of popular thing, and, you know, like in the West, science fiction is a kind of tiny segment of the overall market.
I feel like on a normal week-to-week basis, I'm slightly confused by comic books and culture, but I may be in completely over my head this week. I'm going to have to take you both by the hand, and you're going to have to guide me very gently through all of this.
Okay, so it's this guy, and he's really good at tennis.
Well, let's move on now to our comic book movie and TV news section, and this is going to be a little bit more straightforward, a little bit less anime, because there's not much anime or manga in the news. And a little peek behind the curtain, we're actually recording this a week before you're listening to it, because I'm going to New York this weekend, which is very exciting, but it means we've had to record early, and so all of this news is a week out of date, so just pretend it's not. And if some really exciting comic book news has broken in the past week, we're sorry, we're just not around to talk about it. So
let's hope Stan Lee hangs on for another week.
You know what's going to happen. It's going to be like Sunday night. We're going to get the first trailer of Captain America: Civil War. Monday morning, Stan Lee's going to pop his clogs, and Tuesday night, I don't know, Zack Snyder's going to accidentally tweet the first 20 minutes of Batman versus Superman.
Ben Affleck crashes the Batmobile into the White House.
But for now, hey, there's a Blue Beetle and Booster Gold movie in the works at Warner Brothers.
What?
Ian, is it fair to say that you're not going to be much help on these comics things?
Those don't sound like anime or manga to me, so I'll let James take this one. Sorry, guys.
So, James, this probably would be more Seb-specific with it being DC, but should we be excited about a buddy cop movie with Blue Beetle and Booster Gold, potentially coming from Greg Berlanti, the guy behind Flash, Arrow and Supergirl?
You're right, this is technically Seb's sort of area, because he's the DC Universe guy, but at the same time, I think there's a very strong potential for this to be an interesting series. Booster Gold and Blue Beetle are kind of, they have that sort of buddy cop pairing naturally in the comics. One of them's a time traveler, and one of them gets his powers from a mystic scarab, I think. Seb's going to be shouting at the podcaster. Yeah, so there's that kind of tension between science and mysticism that they can cover. I can imagine it making a sort of fun comedy series. I haven't seen Flash, but I gather that's quite comic booky and light.
Yeah, but this is actually going to be a movie, James.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, this is actually a DC Warner Brothers movie. So even though it's from Greg Berlanti, it's going to be on the big screen, which seems insane given everything else that DC are prepping, but refreshing, I think.
I was going to say, like, my one concern would be that the powers of the characters don't necessarily lend themselves to TV adaptation, but if it's a movie, or the better for it.
Okay. We'll move on now to Jessica Jones on Netflix. We have got our first official look, and who knows, by the time you're listening to this, there could be a trailer, a full trailer as well, which would be very exciting. But James, you love Alias. I think all of us on this podcast love Alias and are very excited about a Jessica Jones TV show. What did you think of these first pictures? Because I know you have something very specific to say about the Purple Man.
Okay, so without being sort of angry nerd guy, I was disappointed that the Purple Man wasn't purple.
Why is that important, James?
Okay, because for me, obviously, a guy being purple and dressing in purple is a completely ludicrous visual. But at the same time, his power is to kind of exert his influence over people in a sort of unbreakable and irresistible way. And part of what makes the character work is that he is literally this purple guy, but no one calls him out on it and no one draws attention to it because he is that powerful that he can just stroll around and, you know, live his life as normal, subtly undermining everyone's perception of him that being purple is fine. So, I mean, I gather there are ways that they might work this into the series. Like, he might be intentionally covering up his purpleness and they're representing that visually.
It could make a lot of sense that he is purple, he's walking around purple, but we're seeing him as not, because that is that he's pulling that trick, so we're kind of seeing through the eyes of Jessica and the other characters, and maybe there's some reveal that he's been purple the whole time.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I wouldn't be at all surprised if final episode, like, Jessica beats the crap out of him and he, in losing his powers or being so weak to use them, appears purple all of a sudden. So, you know, I'm not criticising it for something that I don't know hasn't happened yet.
But you just feel it should be stated that it's important
for the record,
that the purple man is purple. He's wearing a purple scarf, James. Is that not enough for you?
Well, clearly. Clearly not.
What do you think about the use of Hellcat in the Captain Marvel role? Because obviously in the comics, Jessica is friends with Carol Danvers, and Carol Danvers is an important part of the movie universe at the moment, so can't be used on the screen. So they're using Hellcat in that same position.
It's the kind of translation I can understand. Like, I don't think... The thing about Jessica Jones is because she was a continuity insert in the first place, it doesn't really matter that they're changing this, because it's not like she had a rich history with Carol Danvers that they exploited. It was that they invented one for the purposes of the series. So to move it to someone like Hellcat, who is a bit lower tier, a bit less likely to have been hanging out with the Avengers, you know, that for me, that worked.
I think it would. It makes sense that maybe if Chris and Ritter's Jessica Jones did have a superhero past, that it wasn't necessarily with the top tier Marvel heroes.
Yeah, exactly.
In this adaptation. And also, I think it's going to be very interesting, you know, now that we're opening up the Marvel Universe to the idea of, you know, a Spider-Man pre-existing, but he just hasn't had any showed up in any movies yet. I think it'll be quite fun to go down onto the street level and see a character like maybe someone like Hellcat, who is a superhero on the streets, but we haven't interacted with her yet. She's just going around her business and hasn't really got herself onto the radar of someone like the Avengers.
Yeah, you can have this like second wave of characters who are inspired by the Battle of New York to become superheroes, but haven't maybe become the breakout Avengers they want to be.
And it gives the Marvel Universe free range in the future to introduce characters without having to do origin, which is going to be helpful for Luke Cage in the series as well, when he gets his own series straight after this.
It's going to ruin Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.'s entire concept.
Ian, are you looking forward to Jessica Jones? Is that the kind of thing that you might watch? Did you watch Daredevil?
Yeah, I did watch Daredevil. I thought it was really good. I actually think I liked it a bit more than some of the other Marvel films that were coming around that year. But I'll definitely watch anything they put out.
Okay, well, that's it for this week's comic book and TV news. We'll move on now to our spoiler-filled discussion of Ghost in the Shell. But before we dive in, let's listen to the trailer for the movie.
What's a simulated experience again?
All your memories about your wife and daughter are false. They're like a dream. Someone's taken advantage of you. They were trying to make you ghost hack into some government officials. Do you understand what I'm saying?
But that can't be. I had a picture of her. She was there.
The truth is, you've never had a wife or kid. Like he said, they aren't real. They're a simulated experience, a fantasy.
Are we talking about the Puppet Master? The infamous mystery hacker?
We don't know a lot either. No clue about age, sex, or background. All we know for certain is this person is on the international most wanted list for crimes including stock manipulation, illegal information gathering, political engineering, several acts of terrorism. The nickname Puppet Master comes from the ghost hacking.
My code name is Project 2501. I am a living, thinking entity who was created in the sea of information.
Information, even a simulated experience or a dream, is simultaneous reality and fantasy.
The net is vast and infinite.
Ghost in the Shell.
Okay, so that was a taste of Ghost in the Shell. So guys, we should be quite specific here. We are talking about Ghost in the Shell, not Ghost in the Shell 2.0, and the version that we have watched, which is the one that we are discussing, is the original Japanese audio one with English subtitles. Now, do you think... I think it would be good for you to start off by explaining to the audience why we're going with that version and not either of the other two.
Okay. I think both me and James probably watched the English dub version of this film. Like, I don't know. I must have watched it like 15 times as a teenager, a kid, or whatever. And I only actually understood what was going on at all when I actually watched the subtitle version in university. I was like, oh, that's what that film was about. I had no idea.
Yeah, it's like there's a script they use for the dub and a script for the subtitles. And if you don't watch the subtitles, there are fairly large plot points that you can entirely miss.
Yeah.
I mean, just on a very basic level, I bought the DVD which had all three versions on there. And so I watched the subtitle version and then afterwards kind of just had a quick look at the other two. Just on a basic level, it seemed like the performances of the voice actors, they were trying to kind of match their words to the mouth movements of the anime, and that led to a very kind of staccato and wooden delivery of all dialogue.
Yes, I am an anime voice actor. Yeah, it's them trying to fit the script to the mouth movements is folly and ruins a lot of things.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite a common thing, isn't it? Like,
yeah.
I find it utterly bizarre that this is one of the films that managed to sort of cross over. It was like this and Akira managed to make anime a kind of big deal in the West. And it just boggles my mind that it could have done that with such stilted delivery and
an emphasis on the wrong words. There was a couple of key scenes that I was rewatching where just the emphasis on a certain word wasn't there, which you can kind of still get across in the Japanese subtitle version, even if you don't know Japanese, because you can kind of you can kind of hear where the sentence is being punctuated. Mm-hmm. When you read along with the subtitles and. Oh, just basically thinking, oh, that line doesn't have any impact when you emphasise that other word instead.
There's also a lot they do with the kind of like the English voice acting is all done at like full volume. It sounds like they're in a recording studio, but the Japanese voice acting often has environmental effects on it, so it'll sound different out in a street scene as it does in a in like a closed environment, and has like reverb and stuff. So you lose all of that as well with the dub.
I'm not entirely certain that this is the case, but I get the feeling the English dub is recorded line by line, whereas in the Japanese tradition of voice acting, there tends to be a bit more sort of actual emphasis on acting and interplay between characters. It's a bit more like, you know how they record The Simpsons here, which is by getting the cast in a room and letting them read the scenes. I think it's more like that, whereas the English dub to me sounds like it's been someone been given a list of their lines and told them, read these.
Yeah.
And you mentioned about kind of like certain plot points being missed because of the script. Is there any particular examples you can think of that, of something that just doesn't come across in the subtitled version?
Like, the plot is so kind of intricate, and it's about the sort of political wrangling between two internal government agencies in this kind of futuristic Japan, that if you don't have the details in the script, there are things you won't understand about why things have happened, why they've happened. There's a really famous example of how the script for the subtitles and the dub differ.
No, it's at the very beginning where Major Kusanagi is up on the rooftop listening to the kind of political stuff going on in the room where the man she's about to assassinate is. Bato's listening into her mind, and he comments that it's very noisy in there and he doesn't know what's going on. And in the subtitles, she says, it's my time of the month. And in the dub, she says, must be a loose connection or something dumb like that.
So, like, that's the kind of nuance you're losing.
And, well, and for a film that is so heavily, to me, seemed to be commenting on gender and sexuality in the computer age.
Yeah.
How that's a pretty pivotal little nuanced moment right there.
Yeah, exactly. Like, that's the kind of... The line in the subtitles tells you about the character and the world and how people's bodies relate to their cyborg parts.
Mm. And she's got a bit of humour to it, sort of like... It can't possibly be that, so...
Well, yeah, quite.
She's a robot lady.
And then in the dubbed version, it's like a throwaway, you know, plug this gap with a line.
Yeah. Find something that looks like it fits the mouth movements and say it. Mm-hmm.
And then Ghost in the Shell 2.0. So this is a film that were... This is a new version of the film, overseen by the original director in 2008... And kind of has a lot more computer graphics put on top. I mean, to me, it seems like remastered Star Wars, but, you know, the Japanese equivalent of George Lucas tinkering with his original.
Yeah, for me, it's Red Dwarf that always springs to mind, because the additions are so out of place that they just wreck any kind of quality of experience you can take from watching the film.
It's very bizarre. I turned it on for a second and... Like, just watch the opening sequence. The opening sequence kind of has remastered the lead character, Kusanagi, into this fully, like, CG character. And the opening scene, anything with her outside the building is CG, but then when it cuts into the building, it's the old cell animation, the old cell anime animation inside the building. Mm-hmm. And then it stops being CG, and then as the movie goes on, it's kind of like the computer... Inserts are still are like more heavily 3D CG, whereas the rest is still just the original movie. Very odd.
It is an absolute butchering, and they also take this very odd decision to, like, Ghost in the Shell quite famously was entirely tinted green to emphasize the kind of, to make it look like a VDU basically. Which back in the early 90s...
To make it look like The Matrix. It totally ripped off The Matrix, right?
Well, quite. Yeah, we'll get to that. But, like, the... you know, that was a stylistic choice. Whereas in Ghost in the Shell 2, it's entirely tinted orange for no discernible reason.
There were amber monochrome monitors as well, so they were clearly had a fan of that as the art director.
Yeah.
So basically, that what this boils down to is that is why we are discussing specifically in this context the Japanese audio with English subtitles.
Yes.
Okay, guys, can you explain the plot of the movie to our dear listeners? slash also to me.
Can you explain the plot?
I have seen it. I could try. Do you want me to try?
Yeah,
go on.
Okay, so there is Major Kusanagi, who is basically mostly made up out of cyborg and, like, fake parts. There is, like, some of her brain remaining, but she's basically been mostly replaced with this genetic shell. And what's left of her, like, she kind of, like, debates whether she's got a soul left inside, which would be her ghost, or whether there's anything left of her, of the original her, or if there even was an original her.
Mm-hmm.
She works for a place called She works for Section 9, right?
Yeah.
Which is like a government agency, and there is another government agency called Section 6. And she like has like a she works with a guy called Bato, and another guy called Togusa. Togusa's like a rookie cop, and Bato is like her partner. And they are hunting for a hacker called the Puppet Master. am I all right?
Yeah,
so
yeah, yeah, yeah. Doing good so far.
Perfect.
Okay.
10 out of 10.
Okay, because I mean, guys, I really struggled. basically, the world is set in 2029, and the world has become much more computerized. Basically, all the nations have kind of merged in a kind of cyberspace. There is a net which everyone can connect to through these ports in the back of their head, or at least the genetically altered people can. And that there is we're a much more connected world in terms of this net, this virtual world. But on a street level, nations and governments still exist, but are kind of struggling to exist in this more connected world. And the Puppet Master is hacking into things. I'm not quite sure why he's hacking into things or what he wants to do. But I guess that's kind of obscured, because there is another government agency called Section 6 who are also after the Puppet Master. And that's when things start to get confusing.
Okay, so just quickly, like, pretty much everything you said there was correct. The important thing to note is that Section 6, who are, like, they're basically the CIA, I guess. They're sort of in charge of foreign espionage.
Foreign espionage.
They created the Puppet Master to be a weapon.
But we don't know that to start with, do we? We only know that one Section 6 and Section 9 clash.
Yeah.
And the Puppet Master manages to get himself into a shell, into a, like, a genetically into a cyborg body. Puppet Master kind of then explains to them that he wanted to get into this body.
Yeah, well, basically, like,
he started out as Program 2501.
Yeah, they created Project 2501, which was supposed to be a weapon, but it achieved self-awareness, and they, in attempting to capture it and put it back sort of in its box, it took refuge in a cyborg body and then went to Section 9 for asylum, basically. And while in Section 9, it meets the Major and sort of recognises sort of kinship with someone who was also on the border between being cybernetic and human. Mm. And they merge their consciousnesses to create a new life form, and that is the conclusion of the film.
So yeah. there's like a big chase between Section 6 try and get rid of the body, presumably to destroy the Puppet Master and hide what they did.
Yeah, exactly.
Whereas Section 9 go after it, and Kusanagi eventually gets there and kind of dives into the other body to talk to the Puppet Master. And yeah, they find this kind of kinship, and the Puppet Master wants to experience mortality inside a body and offers in return to Kusanagi the kind of opportunity to have a kind of deeper existence on the net, on the kind of cyber plane.
Mm-hmm.
And so that if they merge into one kind of consciousness, they can both achieve what they want to on these different kind of planes of existence.
Yeah.
Okay, so this bit's a bit vague, but the Puppet Master has figured out how to copy his ghost, his actual consciousness, over the internet, basically, which is not something that anyone else is able to do. They mention that it's usually just a kind of a shadow of the actual consciousness when they do that, but he's able to do it correctly. So it allows the Major to take advantage of this method he's worked out, so she can go and exist on the internet, basically.
Yeah, and therefore transmit herself to any other cybernetic body on the planet.
Yeah.
Which, like, that's a desirable state for her.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, and, I mean, James, you put down in our notes, like, one of the first questions, like, we're posing in the notes to each other, that is this film too dense to properly understand the plot on a first viewing? And I think we've kind of explored that here, that I think I was just about able to keep up. But I do wonder whether, like, I mean, Ian, you already mentioned about watching this multiple times, and then, you know, like, you know, watching it with Japanese and actually starting to understand it. But yeah. I wonder whether, like, the point of that might be actually that you probably need to watch this movie a couple of times, once to get your head around the plot, And then if you rewatch it, you don't have to worry about the plot, and then you can actually deal with the ideas of the film and focus on the visuals, because the kind of the themes and the ideas and the way it looks are probably a lot more interesting than just the surface level plot, even if it is hard to keep up with.
Yeah. So I think one of the interesting things about Ghost in the Shell is that it's been like, there's like 15 different Ghost in the Shell properties. There's the comic, there's two TV shows, a series of TV movies, this film, the remake of this film, and a sequel to the film called Innocence. Just tons and tons of stuff that isn't really continuity-wise the same at all. Like, there's always something which stops them being compatible. And I think this takes the bits of the comic and applies a lot of Mamoru Oshii's directorial style to it, which is not really there in any of the other pieces of work. So just the kind of the ponderous interludes. I don't know if you'll have liked those or not, but where he'll just be like, here's 3.5 minutes of stuff and the streets and some music. And the plot grinds to a complete halt during which...
Yeah, I was actually reading... So I went to read a couple of reviews of this movie afterwards, because I was like, they might explain it to me. right at the top of the Rotten Tomatoes page was a 5-star review from one of my favourite critics, Robbie Collin. And he talks about that section, you know, in particular, and says, like... He actually calls that scene the film's centrepiece scene, one of the single greatest animated sequences ever created, where Kusanagi wanders through the nameless city where the people around her make their way silently from place to place, hypnotized by advertising, deafened by the rain, defeated by the rain. Is she still human? Are they? This is a work of profound and melancholic beauty, every bit as essential in the 21st century as it was in the 20th. Which, first of all, great piece of writing. And second of all, I found myself going... oh shit, I need to go back and watch that scene again, because that was the scene that I kind of checked out a little bit on, because there wasn't any dialogue. But I think he's right, but I think that maybe when you're watching the film the first time, that's very difficult to appreciate something like that.
Yeah, the first time you watch it, you're kind of wondering what the point of that sequence is, and it doesn't really... like, the time you get into the sort of deeper ideas are when they're literally discussing them. Like, when they, you know, they're on the boat and they have a discussion about philosophy.
I did kind of get that sense from a lot of the film, that it was kind of like, action sequence, pause and talk about plot and ideas. Action sequence, silent sequence. Pause to talk about more plot and ideas. Action, talk about all of the plot. Action, the end.
There's even a melancholic part where they're chasing, in the middle of a car chase later on. Like, suddenly it's... Kusanagi up on the helicopter, kind of looking sad, waiting for the helicopter to actually get to the car, and it's just shots of them setting up the blockade and people holding sniper rifles, and it's playing kind of like a melancholic music. Yeah, exactly.
Oh, we should talk about that score. That score is properly haunting.
Yeah.
What do you feel about the use of the music in this film?
Oh, like, I love it. I mean, it's so... you know, it's so weird. Original and weird, yeah, and it's so unique to the film. Like, it's notable that when they made the sequel to this film, which, as Ian mentioned, is called Innocence, it's not adapted from the comics, it's just the director came up with his own story and made that. Mm. But it stands out that they brought the Chinese opera back.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've seen the word balletic used quite a lot, and... you know, and operatic, and it does have that sense. And like, I think it might have been in Robbie's review as well, talking about the opening sequence, which is kind of the title sequence, which is kind of where that score kicks in for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
Where you're seeing Kusanagi's body kind of being assembled, her cyborg body being assembled.
Yes.
And the music almost makes it sound like a kind of religious rite.
Mm-hmm. Specifically in that opening sequence, what I think works about that is that it takes the kind of tension of something that is super high-tech happening in front of you and then scores it with what is a kind of ancient traditional art form. Mm. And I think that's very deliberate in kind of giving texture to what is, a cyberpunk dystopia, essentially. Mm. Like, it's a deliberate choice to kind of marry those two... basically disparate ideas and say this is this is the theme of the film, like, how does everything new exist with everything old?
Should we talk about Ghost in the Shell in relationship to its source material? I mean, how close is the relationship? Is this? I mean, you said it is adapting the comic. Is it adapting, like, a certain arc? I mean, because, again, I might be betraying my ignorance to manga, but is this, like, one part of the story in the same way that Akira is just one small part of the manga? Or is it taking disparate ideas from different areas? Or is it even telling the same story? Is it asking the same questions as the manga does?
I mean, there are lots of similar themes and ideas explored in the source material. The important thing to note is that the film is based on a specific arc from the comic, which kind of runs through, basically, in the manga, sort of every chapter, Section 9 will go on a specific case involving their remit of public security. And throughout those cases, they come up against the puppet master in various guises. And when it was collected in the West, they just took the chapters with puppet master content and collected those as the Ghost in the Shell novel. So what happens is, if you want to read the comic in full, you have to buy Ghost in the Shell, and then a kind of supplemental book called Ghost in the Shell 1.5, which is the rest of the chapters that didn't have anything to do with the Puppet Master.
That really, really sucks.
Yeah. Like, there's no... It's annoying, as a fan, that there's no chronological collection of the stories in the order they were published.
Yeah. But so, what you're saying, is it more like, then, in terms of these, like, case of the week kind of things, is it more pulpy in that sense? Does it have the same kind of somber, introspective, you know, exploration of gender and identity and, you know, what identity is in an increasingly computerized world? Or is it more kind of like, hey, here's this criminal that we're facing this week?
Yeah, it's fair to say it's a lot more action-oriented. Like, those themes do come up. But I would say the biggest difference is that the Ghost in the Shell manga is very light-hearted, and, like, there are things like Bato and the major trick Aramaki into... Sorry, they're trying to play a practical joke on him, in which they blow up his exhaust, and he manages to get the drop on them and then, like, rides off on a moped. Like, it's genuinely a hilarious moment to see these, like, soldiers acting like children. But it's fair to say that pretty much every subsequent adaptation just ignored all of that stuff in favour of the more ponderous identity politics and things that were introduced in the anime movie. So, like, the source material is recognisably Ghost in the Shell, and the characters are recognisably themselves, but it's also a lot broader. I would say the main thing that you get from both is the kind of fetishization of technology and specifically weaponry. Like, the manga has footnotes explaining exactly how, like, he'll sketch a gun and then do a sort of 50-60 word explanation of how the reload mechanism works on it or something.
Or he'll draw a submarine and say that the torpedo ports wouldn't actually be here, but it looked better this way when he drew it or something.
Yeah, it's really
detail oriented.
Yeah, the manga is about the technology, whereas the film is about the philosophy.
And so, what's your relationship with the manga, Ian? Like, do you prefer it on the page? I mean, I assume for both of you that the movie was the way in, but
yeah, I have a good appreciation of the manga. I've never actually read the extra chapters, though, so I should definitely do that, as it would allow me to talk better at length about it. But in contrast to that, I think my favourite form of Ghost in the Shell is probably the TV show, Standalone Complex, which is not compatible with the film, which is really irritating, because it's about, like, early on in it, it's about Togusa joining, and then they kind of have... 22 episodes of Villain of the Week stuff, which is intersected with another kind of... they keep running into a a hacker over and over again, and eventually that turns into the plot properly for the last six episodes and stuff. It's really good, but I'm not sure you'll want to watch 17 hours more of Ghost in the Shell at this point. And it also has some of the more kind of tertiary characters in it, which don't manage to make it from the comic into this film. There are some more members of Section 9 who didn't quite make the cut, and it's always fun to see what they're up to.
Yeah, like I would say the TV series is probably the closest to the comic in that it's sometimes funny, and it has every episode has a different idea at the heart of it. The film is about how the Major goes from being in Section 9 to becoming this new life form, whereas the TV series is about sort of how Section 9 establishes itself and how they operate. And so in a way you can see, like, there's one scene in the film in which they refer to Togusa as being a rookie, which, if you took that line of dialogue out, the movie could adequately serve as a kind of bookend to the TV series.
Yes, yeah, that's the only thing that prevents it from being compatible, probably.
Yeah.
And the TV series was made afterwards, right?
Yeah, years afterwards, like 10 years afterwards, maybe.
Yeah.
So how do you feel about the movie dialing up the philosophy as opposed to all the other versions? Do you think it works, and do you think it has the depth that it strives to? Or is there anything in there particularly that you find interesting or that strikes a chord?
It's kind of hard for me to look at it objectively in that sense, because like when I was a teenager and I first watched the movie, the fact that something was exploring those ideas was what excited me about it. Like, obviously, I'd never read William Gibson and The Matrix didn't exist, but that's what excited me. I can't say for certain whether I'd feel the same way if I came to it new. But when I rewatched Ghost in the Shell, the movie, like, that's something that I still enjoy about it, is that, you know, the exploration of those ideas.
Yeah, I think they're pretty interesting additions to it. I think, again, it's a problem with the dub was that a lot of that stuff was very poorly explained in the English acting script. So a combination of the boat scene and then the sequence after that is usually about where I fell asleep while watching Ghost in the Shell, traditionally.
Yeah, and to be woken up by a, you know, machine guns on a tank.
Yeah, someone fighting a tank or something. You're like, oh, cool. So yeah, maybe I don't have the great appreciation for it, but that stuff's back in the sequel.
Yeah, so I mean, I guess, would you say that one of the main themes of the movie is this kind of this search for identity in an era? Well, and this is kind of like pretty presciently predicting what's going to happen, what would happen to us in a more computerized age. And obviously this is full-on sci-fi and you know, much more speculative than where we actually are in 2015, but 20 years later, I think this kind of sense of having online identities, and, you know, as opposed to our real ones, does strike somewhat true. I mean, there's this Blade Runner-esque, I mean, because this film reminded me of Blade Runner an awful lot, partly in the design of this kind of like mash of Western and Eastern culture, and the idea of what makes us human, you know, in this sci-fi setting, and you know, how that can relate back to us looking at our own identities and personalities now.
I was really struck by the existential dread that Major has at one point in the film, where it's where they've found the body of the puppet master that the puppet master has put himself into. And it's the same model as her, or from the same factory that her body was made in. And it seems to have like a ghost in it, and she's talking about how she's never seen her own brain matter or something. So she really has no proof that she's even a real, or ever was a real human. It could all just be illusionary and something so that Section 9 has made up to keep her wanting to work there.
Yeah,
and, I mean, and she can't quit because they own her body.
It's a real Deckard moment.
Yeah.
I tell you,
except Deckard is never smart enough to realise it.
The scene I like is when the guy who's been ghost hacked, and he thinks he's got a family, but he hasn't. He's just like a kind of sleeper agent, and he's, you know, he's got no life, and they're going like, oh, what a sad case, like, he'll probably never recover.
That was one of my favourite scenes in the movie, and mostly because it is dealing with the kind of themes and ideas that the rest of the movie is, but I actually felt something in regards to that guy, whereas I'll be honest, I while I appreciated quite a lot of what this movie was saying, in a way it left me cold in a, like, I didn't feel emotionally invested. Like, this is making me think. Yeah, it was more a cerebral experience. I found it very hard to identify.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
With any of these characters, given that they were all these kind of genetically engineered, physical perfection kind of characters, talking about lives and experiencing ideas that are so far removed from any kind of experience we can have. I found the ideas very interesting, but then when you look at that guy's story, I actually did find properly heartbreaking and tragic, and I think that's probably the one moment where the movie actually emotionally affected me.
Even the arms dealer guy, there's one of those more reflective moments in just after the chase through the market where he's just being stalked by the major, yeah. And suddenly it goes all quiet and he's like running through the water and there's a silent plane that's just overhead for some reason, and he's just standing there in the middle of like a flooded wasteland and just kind of looks sad for some reason. it's a weird moment. But yeah, I think that's why Tokusa's there. It's because you're meant to be the most relatable. I love it, the bit where he starts doing cop stuff. He's like, aha, I noticed the door closed a bit later and I'm checking the lift sensors and I got my revolver. And he's just doing normal cop stuff as opposed to making heads explode.
Yeah, he's not brain hacking anyone.
Yeah.
I felt like you needed a little bit more of him almost. That like maybe if it had been more of a trio rather than feeling like a cop, like these two cops who are partners and this third younger inexperienced guy who occasionally helps them out.
Yeah.
I do wonder whether that he might have served as a better kind of POV character while Kusanagi's kind of there doing all of the interesting cerebral stuff.
Yeah, I mean, you make a good point that he should be the audience entry character, really, because otherwise the main pairing of the film is a woman who is entirely cyborg speaking to a guy who is mostly cyborg.
And I say this fully expecting that that's probably what the live-action adaptation will do, and we'll all hate that it does it, because it'll be dumbing down this idea, giving us a relatable character that we can root for and see this world through his eyes. I mean, when they cast, I don't know, Zac Efron as that part in the American remake, we're all going to hate it, but I'm going to be secretly thinking, thank you for giving me Zac Efron.
the major is pretty universally in all the adaptions a pretty sullen character. She's not you're never really meant to feel all that much for her, I don't think. She just doesn't have a range of emotions in them.
In a sense, that's quite interesting that she is that sort of character. I know there are a lot of people who really kind of idolise her as a character simply because she is probably as developed as someone, you know, sort of male action leads. You know, she's kind of a cybernetic John McClane.
Yeah, I mean, she's definitely a well-sketched character, and she definitely is interesting and is thinking interesting things. And that's what I mean, intellectually, she was my favourite character, but, I just couldn't connect with her on an emotional level.
Mm-hmm.
But I know what you mean about the fact that, I mean, and we should probably talk about this next, that the fact that she is a female action lead, but that it's not, the action isn't really what defines her, because I think there's such a shortcut in movies to going, okay, so this female character is doing badass action stuff, so isn't she a strong character?
Mm-hmm.
Well, no, not necessarily. I mean, she might be strong physically, but that doesn't necessarily mean you've sketched a good character. It just means you've drawn a bad character in the way that you have 99% of the time for men as well.
Yeah.
In that kind of role. But that definitely isn't the case here. And I think if that's the reason, you know, if that's a reason why people really like this character, because yes, she's badass and kick-ass, but she is also super, super interesting and has like an interior emotional life that you can at least understand, then
mm-hmm.
yeah, I completely understand that. What I do find interesting though is how this film kind of looks at gender and looks at sexuality, because it seems to me that this film is kind of saying in a computer age that those kind of things become less and less relevant, and almost the fact that this movie leads to the birth of a new life form between a person and a computer program merging almost removes the need for gender and sexuality in this computerized world whatsoever.
Okay, so I'm going to tell you two interesting things about the comic then.
Excellent.
In the comic, it's made explicit in, I use the word literally, that the Major is a lesbian.
Right.
And also, in the final sequence, she is in a male body rather than the body of a young girl. Like, when she wakes up after merging with the Puppet Master, she's got her own head, but the body she's in is male.
Right, okay.
And in the film, they switch that to being a young girl. You know, those ideas that you're talking about are explicitly part of Ghost in the Shell in most of its forms, I would say.
You have, like, the Puppet Master speaking with a male voice out of two different female bodies.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
yeah.
It's definitely kind of has the message that gender is, like, a choice, almost.
And there is quite a lot of nudity in this movie.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, quite regularly with Kusanagi. And when she was naked, yes, she had breasts and she had a noticeably female body. I wasn't sure whether she was supposed to have female genitalia or not, or whether that was something that, like, she had been built into this, like, perfect kind of strong fighter who can be perfect in this government agency, whether actually she didn't need genitalia and that it wasn't there. or is that just the animation not showing anything?
The comic makes it clearer that the body she's in is supposed to be like an adult female and working like an adult female's. I think right. in the anime, yeah, they tend to use the nudity, like they don't use it for titillation. Like they basically try and make it as practical as possible with the intention of showing that she doesn't really, like, she doesn't have any hang-ups and she doesn't think of herself as naked because it's not her body.
Yeah.
Like, you could potentially accuse it of being sort of male-gazy in the way that her body is kind of this sort of perfect, gynoid form. Mm. But I think, especially if you're familiar with other anime and you see the kind of thing, it's called, like, in anime, it's called fan service, which is, like, there is a female character, so in this episode, she's going to be in a swimsuit for spurious reasons. And I think appreciating...
Yeah, all of popular culture.
Yeah, well, quite. But more, yeah. A lot more so, considerably more so in anime, that is a trope you'll encounter.
And I actually thought this movie felt oddly, like, sexless. Like, when the male and female characters were together, and considering how often the Major was naked, I think there's only one moment where, like, Bato kind of looks at her taking her swimsuit off after she gets out of the pool and kind of, like, looks and kind of then goes, oh, no, I shouldn't be looking, and looks away. But mostly, the discussions that are being had when she is naked are just so matter-of-fact, and she'll be stood there naked in front of male characters, and they don't give second thoughts to the fact that she's naked, and she doesn't give second thoughts to the fact that she's naked. So, it to me felt almost like this was a world being presented almost where sex was falling away because of this cyberscape.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, I mean, I think that's a fair interpretation of what they show.
It's very sterile whenever it happens.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. They've got the torso of the Puppet Master lady there, but there's nothing particularly sexualized about it, despite...
Unless that's
showing
your thing. But
yeah, exactly.
But yeah, it's not...
I got the sense most of the time when we were seeing her body that it was like, yes, you were supposed to be kind of objectifying it in a way, but not in a sexual way, more in a wow, this is like a perfect physical form kind of way, and she has all the muscle she needs to do, you know, whatever task she's going to come up against, and then that's really amplified in that final scene where she's trying to rip that like gun robot apart,
yeah,
and all her muscles start bulging, and eventually her arms even rip off.
Yeah,
for some reason, there are a few bits of this film that make it into every single Ghost in the Shell adaptation, and that's one of them. At some point, the major will attempt to rip the hatch off a tank and rip off her own arms in the process. Just as well as there's always a scene where she'll be on the top of a building and fall past the window, shoot someone in the head until their head explodes, and then go into optical camouflage.
Actually, that's a very nice segue into my next question was going to be, I mean, so if we loosely agree that the nudity is not gratuitous, do you think the violence is gratuitous, particularly that kind of like head exploding, seeing spinal cords and bones popping out of skin and all that kind of stuff?
Were you expecting that in the intro there?
No.
Yeah.
I mean, I kind of see it as a deliberate choice to, like, it's so matter of fact about people being, like, the fact that some of these people are mostly made of metal, that I think it's also emphasising that other people are still flesh and bone.
But do you think, and emphasising how brittle they are?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's definitely an element of it in, like, saying, you know, you're fragile and this person isn't. Like, this is the future. Like, it's sort of something that you can draw more on from when you've seen other adaptations. But I think that's definitely part of Ghost in the Shell's overall fabric, is the idea that technology is stronger than flesh and bone.
Yeah.
And Tokus is always considered a bit of a weirdo for not being more cyberized than he is.
He's got a cyber brain, which is like a casing around your brain that allows you to plug into the net.
So you can shout into each other's brains.
Yeah. But the Major is pretty much the only character who is entirely entirely cyborg, aside from her brain, because she was put in that body as a young child, whereas Togusa is the only one who just has a cyborg, a cyber brain implant.
Skype, basically, in his brain.
James, one of the other questions that you've posed in the notes is whether we think that the property fetishizes the power of covert security services. What do you think about that kind of theme of the movie? Because this is, I mean, we've got like two kind of warring factions who seem to be, you know, kind of like just different sections of the same government.
I mean, it's something that I wrestle with when I watch Ghost in the Shell. It's kind of, I enjoy the action and the political wrangling, but at the same time, like, if a agency like Section 9 or even Section 6 was, like, openly operating, you would be absolutely terrified. Because, like, they, you know, they execute foreign and local nationals sort of at their own whim. Like, they don't seem to answer to anyone. I sort of compare it to, just to keep regular listeners interested, it's kind of like, people talk about how some superheroes can be interpreted as kind of like fascist, like Batman beating up the poor or whatever. And it's like, in real life, if there was a guy, a millionaire who went around kicking the hell out of basically mentally ill people, like, you would not enjoy that person. You would not root for him. And it sort of, it comes back to that with me. Like, if Section 9 existed, no matter how pure their intentions appear to be, you would be horrified to see them in the street. Like, if they appeared, you would run the other way.
It's something that runs through superhero movies, isn't it? I think we're probably going to get to it more and more in the Marvel Cinematic Universe when we get through to the movies that have a lot more of S.H.I.E.L.D. involvement. The way that security services are depicted in comics and these kind of movies, and, you know, whether we should be rooting for them or not. I think it's one of the reasons why I'm continually reading comics or watching comic book movies and coming back to Bond and, like, thinking, that reminds me of Bond in that certain way or in that other certain way. I'm sure there is, like, a really direct relationship between those two. It's interesting that Bond is now going to become a comic. But yeah, I think it's maybe a theme that we're going to keep revisiting on this podcast, the way that security services are depicted.
Yeah, it's sort of... I tell you what it reminds me of most, actually, and I, even as someone who hasn't actually watched 24, like, I feel like there's a lot of CTU in Section 9.
Definitely. And for a larger discussion on this, I think watching towards the end of that first season of the TV show, some of the other elements of the Japanese government realize what Section 9 are doing and try very hard to stop them from doing it. They're like, oh no, we can't have you doing that. What's this?
Yeah.
So yeah, there's a good exploration of whether Section 9 should be allowed to exist in that stuff, which I believe
the answer they come to is no as well.
No.
Okay, in regards to this film and kind of the impact it's had since, so obviously this was, as you say, kind of like one of the two key texts in terms of anime that had a kind of crossover Western appeal. And, I mean, the obvious one is The Matrix. I mean, and it's obvious from kind of the word go, and you see those green numbers, the number the number rain kind of going down the screen, and you're like, oh, this came out 4 years before The Matrix. I think the Wachowskis have been fairly open about, you know, being influenced by various properties, and this being one of the key ones. But what kind of impacts do you think it had on, you know, like, film culture in the years since?
One thing I would say, actually, is it and Akira have kind of a lot to answer for in significantly narrowing people's perception of what anime is and what it can do.
That's accurate.
They're very, like, as much as I like both Ghost in the Shell and Akira, they're very kind of action, sci-fi oriented properties.
Horribly violent.
Horribly violent, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Mm. Like, and people tend to associate the genre with... the medium, sorry, with those two films, which are actually a very narrow part of the genre. Like, it's reversed a little bit now that Studio Ghibli and stuff have penetrated the popular culture to some extent as well. As much as I love those films, I think they kind of obscure what is interesting and good about anime, which is that it's a very broad medium that can do, and frequently does, a lot more than you'll see in live-action cinema. Not least because it's comparatively a lot cheaper to put together an anime film than to shoot something a little weird and offbeat.
Okay, so well, let's explore then directly. What do you think, what has Ghost in the Shell influenced outside of The Matrix? Or specifically in The Matrix, what influence did it have?
Well, like in The Matrix, like, it's sort of, as well as the thematics, they went to the, like, it's down, literally down to, they steal individual shots from Ghost in the Shell and just replicate them in The Matrix.
The watermelons.
Like, yeah, like, someone running away gets shot and a watermelon explodes. Like, they take refuge behind a pillar and someone machine guns the side of the pillar and it kind of, you know, collapses in. Like, if you start looking...
Do you think
looking,
that's direct homage, though, rather than...
Definitely. Like, if you look how the shots are constructed... Like, there's just no question of it being them going, oh, let's just copy that bit.
And then so, like, them jacking into this virtual plane through ports in the back of their neck.
Mm-hmm.
And we also mentioned the green rain and some of the thematic ideas. By the way, I love The Matrix. I think The Matrix is an amazing
yeah,
film. And even if it stole every frame from all these other things, it's still brilliant. Also, very controversially, is it a superhero movie? Should it be on the docket for a future cinematic universe?
That's a good question, yeah.
We should put that out to listeners. Listeners on Twitter, like, get back to us and tell us whether we should be covering The Matrix at some point.
Please bear in mind, you would have to watch the sequels if you admit that the first one is also a superhero film.
Maybe.
There are Matrix comics.
There's a Matrix anime.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it ends with Neo literally Supermaning it up into the sky. Is there anything else you guys want to discuss specifically about the film?
Generally, I was going to say, how would you rate it? Like, did you think it was a great film, or was it just a kind of think piece for you personally?
Like I say, I think, like, intellectually, I definitely engaged with it, and maybe emotionally, not so much.
Yeah.
I thought some of the animation was incredible. I much preferred it to Akira, I've got to say.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not completely on board with Akira.
Akira's not a really good... It's not a particularly great film, but it was just one that everyone saw, so...
I don't think so. But yeah, so there was lots of stuff that I really liked about it and found very interesting. Like I said, I did watch this movie earlier today for the first time, and I'm not sure I was able to fully get to grips with it. And like a detailed like hour long conversation like this is helpful to doing that, but I almost don't feel qualified to fully like dish out a judgment on it.
Fair enough.
But I would say intrigued, and yeah, I would quite like to maybe in a few weeks or a few months' time just pop it back in and pop back in the DVD player and try and grapple with it once again.
Yeah, I was very interested going into this to hear what someone who's just watched it for the first time thinks, because it was such a big part of my formative years, let's say. I had it on VHS back when I first found the weird anime section at the back of a MVC or whatever it was at the time.
Yeah, I first watched it on Sci-Fi in probably sort of 97 or 98, maybe.
Yeah.
And I went out and bought the VHS, and it was the first DVD I bought. When I went to uni, I replaced my VHSs with DVDs, and I bought this and Groundhog Day and The Craft.
Okay, so before we move on to your recommendations and the pitch, we should probably discuss that this movie is... at the moment in development for a live-action American remake. And obviously we'll have to wait and see whether this does actually come to pass, because, you know, a film we just mentioned, Akira, has been trying to assemble some kind of live-action production for many, many years now and stumbling at almost every turn. But at the moment, a Ghost in the Shell live-action movie is set for March 2017 release, directed by Rupert Sanders, and starring Scarlett Johansson in the lead role as the Major. What do you guys think about that? Because I know the internet reacted fairly vociferously at the time that casting was announced.
Specifically, I would say there has never been... Like, I'm happy to be proven wrong if anyone can think of one, but I don't think there's ever been a successful live-action adaptation of anime.
No, there has not.
And I think to take...
Is that the same case for manga?
Well, no, because The Ring... Was The Ring a novel or manga first?
That's a good question.
An Old Boy's a manga, right?
Well, okay, yeah, of course. Oh, yeah, Old Boy's a good one, then. But things like Battle Royale was I think that was a novel and a manga before it was a film.
Right.
Like, that, you know.
So, and you would have to imagine, probably, that this adaptation is riffing on the movie rather than the manga.
Well, that's the thing. Like,
the movie is what has some cachet with Western audiences.
Yeah, exactly. So the movie is going to be the inspiration for the live-action movie, I would say, with almost certainty.
Hmm.
And that... for me, means we should rank it alongside the likes of Avatar and Dragon Ball rather than, you know, anything that remotely worked.
Right.
If they stick to the source material as accurately as they can, it has the chance of at least being somewhat admirable. Stuff like Dragon Ball, it's just like, oh no, we set it in the real world. And it's like, why?
Yeah.
Why would you... Why would you do that? So if they really, really genuinely go for it, I don't really care who is playing the Major. But it would be interesting to see what that looks like.
It seems like it has a lot of... most of the anime seems very readily adaptable into a live-action Hollywood movie. Because half of the movie is action.
Yeah.
Like, it fully is half the movie is action, and you've got... So that straight away, you've got a Hollywood movie with, like, four big action set pieces, and you kind of scatter this thought-provoking sci-fi idea stuff around it. I could really see it working if they try and I mean, this would be my advice to whoever is writing the script to... take the ideas of the of the anime and keep maybe some of the key conversations, but mostly just try and make it a more understandable, accessible, maybe just make the plot a little bit more straightforward.
Yeah,
and then just leave the ideas stuff in there.
Yeah.
I mean
it's worth pointing out, like, Scarlett Johansson was in Her, which I think is a movie that explores similar territory in terms of computers and identity. I mean, it does it through a different filter, but it's not like it's an entirely alien concept.
I have a real bee in my bonnet about the online reaction to Scarlett Johansson's casting in this. And I had a slightly different bee in my bonnet when I heard it the first time, and it's kind of mutated after actually seeing the movie. The first one was that, so it seems, yes, like, whitewashing is a problem in Hollywood, and it's a problem in Western popular culture, and it's a really bad thing. What really bugs me is that every time something like this happens and Scarlett Johansson is cast as this character in a Eastern property, people say, like, oh, this is ridiculous. Scarlett Johansson shouldn't be playing this character. I'll tell you who should. Rinko Kikuchi. What, the one Japanese actress you can think of, you mean? You mean, like, the one Japanese actress who was in Pacific Rim a couple of years ago?
Yeah.
And it's like the same thing, like, when people are saying, there should be a black James Bond. It should be Idris Elba. Okay, I mean, okay, personally, I don't think Idris Elba would be a very good Bond. I think he's a very good actor. I don't think he'd be right for Bond in the same way that I don't think Ryan Gosling would be right for Bond. the two actors who, for me, don't fit perfectly with Bond. Like, why are you, like, have you got any other suggestions? Like, I'm all behind having a black Bond. Hey, what about an Asian Bond? No one ever mentions that. How about we have, like, a British Indian or a British Pakistani Bond? Like, what about all these different ethnic minorities? And people never seem to, like, it's always like, no, it should be Idris Elba.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we get very focused on this specific idea. And, I think that's almost more patronising to the culture that you're talking about, or the race that you're talking about, than it is to cast someone like Scarlett Johansson as a character like Kusanagi. The second point after watching this film was, actually, I think if you cast up this film around Scarlett Johansson, I think this is the crucial thing, if you cast the rest of the film around Scarlett Johansson as majority Japanese, and I would, you know, like, so a character like, was it Togusa?
Togusa.
If they cast, like, you know, characters like him with Japanese actors, I think that's a lot more important, because weirdly, and yes, the wider issue of whitewashing is still a problem, but weirdly in this particular instance, I think a white actress could be very interesting, given that she is mostly cyborg, and that she has been kind of constructed as this, like, yeah, she is this kind of, like, physically perfect, like, in the comics, in the anime, muscular, but also, like, curvaceous, and Scarlett Johansson, I think, would be a very interesting casting for that, in the exact same way that she was an incredible casting choice for Under the Skin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's fair to say, like, if you're going to do it with any character, the Major is someone who could stand up to that kind of reinterpretation. Simply because, like, she's, you know, it's debatable whether she'd even see herself as Japanese.
Yeah, and especially given that the movie, actually, I mean, I know you said it's been, like, very clearly stated as Japan in the other, you know, in the manga or in the TV show or whatever, but in the movie, it's very carefully the nation is never referred to.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, it looks Eastern, but it looks Eastern in the same way that Los Angeles does in Blade Runner. Scarlett Johansson to me seemed a stunningly good casting choice based on the movie that I watched.
Yeah, yeah. Like, you can sort of say, the point I would say is, if it's an adaptation, and it's quite likely they'll be writing it as Wes, as in the West, and casting it as Wes using Western actors. Like, it is an adaptation, it's not a direct interpretation of the film, and in the film, their nationality is not a point. It's not like the Major is the one Japanese character in a room of white people.
Mm.
In which case, removing her ethnicity would be a problem. But if you're just doing a Western translation, well, that's not, you know, that's not as big an issue as removing from visibility characters of ethnic minorities in settings where they are minorities.
Like I say, I think I would have much more of a problem if this movie announces like a completely white cast around her than I would if it's just her or just a variety of characters.
I guess it depends where they keep the character. Like, if they have a white guy called Ishikawa, that's going to be weird.
And in regards to Scarlett Johansson directly, I mean, I mentioned Under the Skin. I don't know, have you guys seen Under the Skin?
I'm afraid not, no.
No.
It's one of my favourite movies of last year and probably of, like, the last decade. It's just an incredible
Yeah, I've been meaning to watch it for ages, but...
And I would actually say, after having watched it, there are things about it that Ghost in the Shell was reminding me of scenes in Under the Skin, particularly this title sequence where her body is constructed. There is a similar conceit in Under the Skin, and in Under the Skin, she is an alien being kind of put into like a human skin.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, there are definitely visual things, and the whole idea of gender identity is definitely a theme that runs through that film as well.
Yeah,
it much more in regards to sexuality in Under the Skin, but yeah, it shares some ideas and some visual ideas. I'd be very interested if anyone's written about that or if Jonathan Glazer's spoken about it. It might just be pure coincidence, Okay, so. Is this still the seminal manga adaptation that deserves to be talked about above all others?
Well, as James said earlier, it's just one of the ones that there was this big kind of like push. I think it was early 90s to get a whole bunch of stuff across, and there was like this and Ninja Blaze and a lot of hentai, which they accidentally brought over as well and didn't really know what to do with.
Hentai's the porn, right?
Yeah.
You know that.
I've never heard of it before.
Violence Jack Urutsukidoji. Often the worst translations, just incomprehensible butcherings of the source material combined with British censorship laws that just absolute nonsense. It's quite remarkable. The worst thing is Geno Cyber. You should look that up sometime. As I said, this was one of the first real kind of breakout hits. It's like, oh no, anime's cool. You should see Akira and Ghost in the Shell and Ninja Scroll. And I think it's a good way to open the door into further anime. Like, sorry to keep banging on about it, but that TV show is quite something. And then you kind of break out from that and realize, oh, there's stuff like As a Manga Dior and whatever your anime genre of choice, because as James said earlier, it's a medium, not a genre. There's so many different genres of anime, and it's just a good way to say, oh no, I can deal with reading subtitles. It's not that much of a pain when you get down to it.
Yeah, that's a good point. Ghost in the Shell, as a, like, it's got some big ideas, but as a film, it's got a familiar structure, and it's sort of an action, you know, a futuristic action thriller. Like, it's the kind of film you can watch, and then once you've seen it, you're like, well, now I see what the appeal of the medium is, in that it can do high-budget things that work without requiring insanely huge budgets. And then that kind of leads you on to, if this cartoon can be for an adult, what about this cartoon?
Yeah, because if you think about the scale of that film, the sets, the visuals and such, it would have been literally impossible to do anything with such a big scale for that budget at that time. Like, you just couldn't do it. The big city shots, just the robot being formed and such, it would be impossible to do. So, yeah, the medium does allow writers to kind of expand the horizons of what they're actually showing on screen into areas which they couldn't do otherwise.
Okay, so what you're basically saying is that Ghost in the Shell could act as a great doorway for anyone who enjoys this movie into lots of other anime on screen. And not just anime that's like this, but just the wider landscape of
all. Like, it's how I got into anime. Right. Like, you know, everyone had seen little bits like Ulysses or Cities of Gold or whatever.
Yeah.
I
watched that relatively recently.
My anime has been strictly Ghibli, really, up until this point.
Yeah, so if nothing else, it's interesting that you can, like, Ghibli is basically sort of the Pixar Disney of Japan, in that it's family friendly, aimed at all ages, and Ghost in the Shell is something different to that within the same medium.
Yeah. Okay. So, if we're talking about there, the film being a gateway into more anime, we reach our recommendation section now, where Ghost in the Shell can act as a gateway into more comics. Now, I don't know whether you're going to go down the route of Western comics or manga or Ghost in the Shell specifically. So, guys, hit me with your comic book recommendations.
Sure, yeah. Okay, so there's a manga, also an anime, but specifically in this case a manga called XL Saga. It's much more comedic than Ghost in the Shell. It's about an evil organization trying to take over the world, but they only have 3 staff members. So instead of taking over the world, they decide to start out small and take over a single part of a city. Yes, it's about their attempts to do that. And it does have a robot in it, just to tie it in with Ghost in the Shell. I think James is also a pretty decent fan of it.
The thing I would point out is that XL Saga is kind of a parody of the sort of thing that Ghost in the Shell is. Like,
yes.
There are also sort of Sentai elements in it as well, but basically, XL Saga is kind of a parody of the action genre within manga and anime.
It's really good.
Yeah, it's very funny. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, James, what have you got for me?
I mean, I've got two. There are 2 ways this can go. Like, are you interested? Knowing that the graphic novel of Ghost in the Shell is pretty large, are you interested in reading? Like, it kind of has to be bought at least and read as one entity. So are you interested in doing that, or should I recommend you the first installment of a similar but different series?
I mean, I'm interested, but for podcast purposes and actually doing it in a week's time on the podcast.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Yes.
Okay, so I'm going to go with, it's a similar genre in that it's a kind of cyberpunk action. It's by completely different creators. It's got almost no connection to Ghost in the Shell besides that. It's called Gantz, GANTZ.
Okay.
It's published by Dark Horse, I think, in the West. I may be wrong. Cut that. If I am, I'll check. And essentially, it's about a team of people who are saved from the moment of death and tasked with winning their freedom by repelling an alien invasion using sort of futuristic weaponry.
Wow.
It's got a very high cast turnover, like big ideas, lots of craziness. I would say, if of all the manga series I've ever read, I think it's probably the most ripe for Western adaptation, because the high concept is fantastic. But as a manga, it's also very accessible.
Excellent. Okay. Well, we'll move on now to our final section, which is the pitch. And given that we've just been talking about an anime film which is being adapted to live action, I would like you two guys to pitch to me which live action film you think would be best suited to an anime adaptation.
Okay. This is, as we're saying, like the content of anime is so broad that basically any film could be done in an anime style. So the one I've gone for, I almost went for Pacific Rim just because I think it's the only way we'll ever see more Pacific Rim. But yeah. my pitch is for a Fight Club anime, which is about it's a sequel to Fight Club where the narrator goes around different cities. It's kind of an anthology style anime series where he meets people who have other identities, like he has Tyler Durden, and about 2/3 of the way through they get in a fight, and his Tyler Durden fights their Tyler Durden, and at the end of it one of them is left standing.
Okay.
Because I think, that plays to the tropes of anime. In there's a big thing about having sort of anthology storytelling and also having gratuitous action in the sort of superhero tradition, where there is a fight, which is also a metaphor, and then at the end, everything's back to normal.
Excellent. Ian, what do you reckon? What live-action film would be suited to anime?
When I read that question, for some reason, the first thing that popped into my head was Mad Max. And the reason I say that is that, like the very first few anime films, Mad Max would be appropriately violent and ridiculous. You could do some stuff that you wouldn't actually be able to do in Mad Max, except that Fury Road has done somehow managed to do some of the more ridiculous things that were in my head.
George Miller is sat there listening to this podcast. Hi, George. I know you're a big fan. Thinking, yes. Hello, Ian, you Miller. Idiot, I can do anything that anime can do. Did you not watch my last movie?
But there's also this anime genre called a harem anime, and it's about a kind of... the main character, for inexplicable reasons, attracts a harem of women who follow him around and beat him up. And an example of this is Love Hina, for the record. And I think that Fury Road film, like, he could be trying to save the harem from, you know, Morton Joe or something like that, and it could become a comedic harem show in the middle of a ridiculously violent apocalyptic thing. And anime has like apocalyptic stuff, like Fist of the North Star as well, so I think it would fit in there. So
it's excellent. Worth pointing out, like, the harem show tradition is kind of evidence of anime's worst.
Maybe it's terrible.
Yeah, it's probably fair to say it's not even just anime as a genre. It's like the kind of Japanese culture's attitude to women is at times incomprehensible from a Western feminist perspective. And yes. I think harem shows are a definite example of how you'll just watch it and be like, I have no idea how this made it to TV, and yet there are thousands of them.
Yeah, why are all the shows this exact story?
Yeah, they're about like how a whiny, like, idiot has hundreds of women who are inexplicably attracted to him.
Yeah, but wait, they also beat him up.
Oh yeah, but in an affectionate way.
Oh, okay. In your version, is it going to be that kind of crap version, Ian? I mean, I need to know whether it's going to be good or not.
I think if they keep the Mad Max in a coma, it could be a subversive harem anime where, like,
they need his, like, blood for something, or...
Yeah, like, it's about the women, but he's just there in a coma.
Or could they change it where, like, the men are following Furiosa around? but flip it so she still beats them up?
Yes, absolutely they could do that.
Just thinking how you can get that character in an anime. And then George Miller can readapt it for Mad Max 5.
All right, screw all those other ideas. Make a Furious anime.
Okay, Ian wins the pitch this week.
Oh, God damn it.
Excellent work. We really developed that well together, I feel.
I didn't deserve that at all.
I shouldn't have helped.
Basically, the winner of this pitch is increasingly the one who I go, ooh, I like that idea. Can I add this thing to it?
Is it the last one, usually?
Yeah, I'll go second next time.
Yeah.
See if that works.
So Ian wins the pitch this week. Ian, would you like to let our listeners know where they can find you online?
Yeah, I'm Creeman on Twitter. That's pretty much the only place you'll be able to find me at the moment, unfortunately. So,
okay, so
if you dig up my distant past, you'll find various aborted blogs where I reviewed anime. So
start a new one. You've got this huge cinematic universe audience to build on now.
Yeah.
Okay, well, that is it for this week's show. If you're enjoying the show, then please do subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, Player FM, or your podcast app of choice. And if you've already subscribed, then please leave us a rating or review. You can find us on Facebook, on Twitter, @CU_podcast, and send us an email to cinematicuniversepod@gmail.com. You can find previous episodes of the podcast at cinematicuniverse.libsyn.com, and because this is a Film Divider podcast, on filmdivider.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Goodbye.
Bye.
to Homo neanderthalensis, his mutant cousin, Homo sapiens, was an aberration. Peaceful cohabitation, if it ever existed, was short-lived. Records show, without exception, that the arrival of the mutated human species in any region was followed by the immediate extinction of their less evolved kin. Cinematic Universe returns in 2 weeks' time with X-Men First Class.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.